Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Hardworking and dependable. Test drive a Silverado at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer today. Chevy, drive Chicago.
Yeah, funny man. Hey, Tom Dreesen, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How you doing?
I'm good. I went to the Tom Dreesen website, right? And there's this 007 music, a bit of what I just played. I guess like a parody, if you will. Very cool. Very, very nice.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
No, I mean, seriously, it was something I didn't expect at all, quite frankly.
That website gets a lot of hits, TomDreesen.com, that gets a lot of... Because what's so nice about this, you don't have to explain things to anybody anymore. You just say, oh, go to TomDreesen.com or JohnLinedecker.com. And all the information is there. How you get a hold of me, the shows, that's everything right. Is all there.
Yeah, that's so true. That's true. Well,
social media is... I'm sorry, I was going to say, in my day when you started out, everywhere you went in America, people say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. The next question out of the mouth was, oh, yeah? Have you ever been on Johnny Carson? So there was a stairway to stardom, and it was get to the Tonight Show. There wasn't cable shows in those days, so you had to learn to write material that could make grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, and the kids laugh. You couldn't say damn or go to hell on national television. So there was a stairway to stardom. Get to the Tonight Show. Today, it's this social media. These kids today, they pack arenas just through Instagram and TikTok and Twitter and all that. They actually sell out arenas just from the social media, and they're not doing their act. They're doing like one or two jokes.
It's amazing. I've heard that story that you started out with that comics who were appearing in the Los Angeles area, or really anywhere, that the goal was, back in that day, you got to get on the Tonight Show. And if you get on the Tonight Show, then you've got a real career boost. And, by the way, if Johnny asks you to come over and sit down after your set, you're really in. How many times are you on the Tonight Show?
61. But here's the thing. If you had been on the Tonight Show in those days, to America, you had arrived. But to our industry, you hadn't arrived until Johnny called you over to sit and talk with him.
Exactly.
And usually it would be like your third spot, your third time on, because he wanted to see if you had staying power, not if you just had one six-minute set, if you had staying power. So when you sat down with Johnny, then you had arrived, that was well, I did. Freddie Prinze did one appearance on The Tonight Show, and the following day he got a sitcom, and 3 weeks later, I think he was on the cover of Time magazine. It was amazing the power of that show. But in those days, television was ABC, NBC, CBS.
Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't all the cable shows. And my personal, I was out here with a wife and three kids on the unemployment, hitchhiking to the Comedy Store every night. And after my first appearance on The Tonight Show, I've never stopped working from that night. That was the show launched you. Once I did The Tonight Show, my whole life changed. From that point on, I was doing Dinah Shore, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, Johnny Carson, Midnight Special, Rock Concert, Soul Train. I was the only white comedian to ever be on Soul Train. I was doing Hollywood Squares, $20,000 Pyramid. All those shows were just, beat the clock. Everything I was,
beat the clock.
It was amazing the power of that show in those days. Yeah. Not to mention that a guy named Lee Curlin was watching The Tonight Show. He's the head of CBS in New York. And he was watching The Tonight Show that night, and he saw me and signed me to a development deal. Mind you, I'm in the unemployment one day, and the following day, I get a check from CBS for $10,000 and $1,850 a month for a year. In those days, now my groceries, my rent was $225 a month, and I couldn't meet that. All of a sudden, my everything was paid for a year. I could write material and concentrate on it.
Well, that's the Hollywood dream,
Can I tell your audience the most exciting thing in my comedy career was the night you and Bob Surratt came to Le Pub.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and I want to tell a story.
Oh,
I told your producer I was going to tell
it. Go ahead. Go ahead. The most exciting thing in his comedy career. Right. All right. Here we go.
There weren't any comedy clubs in Chicago at that time. I had gone to New York with Tim Reed. Tim Reed and I were a comedy team at that time. We were America's first black and white comedy team. In history shows, we were the last, you know. In fact, we're coming to Chicago, and it's already, I'm not trying to pull anything, because it's already sold out. We're going to the Newbery Library at on May 16th. They're doing a whole hour interviewing Tim and I about Mr. Kelly's and what it meant to get to Mr. Kelly's in Chicago, which you know is now as Dipson's Steakhouse. But so Ron Rappaport, who we wrote a book years ago called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White, and Ron Rappaport, sports writer and author, co-wrote it with us. He's going to moderate and interview Tim and I on May 16th at the Newbery Library. It's going to be a lot of fun.
That's fabulous.
At that time, there weren't any comedy clubs in Chicago. I went to New York with Tim, and we saw the improvisation and said, wait a minute, you mean comedians could go work out every night and work on their act? In those days in Chicago, Tim and I had to write a nightclub act because there weren't any open mics. There wasn't any place like that in 1969, 1970. So when I came back from New York, I said, wow, these kids in New York, they can go to a club every night and work on their material. So I went to a guy named Henry Norton. He owned a place called Le Pub on, I think, on Lincoln Avenue. Yeah, that's what we're... Anyhow, I said to him, what is your slowest night? He said, Monday night is a real slow night. So I said, could I start a comedy room here? And he said, sure. And I went on a bunch of shows and stuff to get people to come there. And so all of a sudden, it was packed every Monday night, and I would have maybe 15 acts. They would each do 6 to 10 minutes. You know, new kids. We had what we call a virgin spot. Somebody who had never done it before. They would get it for the first time. Then we had good acts in Chicago at that time. They could hold their own for 10, 15 minutes. So it was a fun night. But one night, Bob Surratt and John Records Landecker come in the room. You prominent radio personalities. And Bob Surratt, I said, Bob, are you going to do stand-up? He said, no, John has been preparing a routine, and he's going to get up and do stand-up. And I said, oh, that's great. He said, he's never done it before, but this is his night. I mean, he's emceed a lot of events. I said, oh, that's great. But poor John, to your audience, I want to let you know that John was a little nervous, and he thought, well, maybe a pitcher of beer would calm me down. So he finished that pitcher of beer, and he thought, well, maybe another pitcher of beer would calm me down. And he went on stage after two pitchers of beer, and it didn't work so well. And so when he came,
that's an understatement.
And when John came off stage, he said to me, have you got any advice? I said, yeah, don't drink two pitchers of beer before you try out your first time on stage. But you were such a good sport, and we've laughed about this for years.
I don't know how many years later it was, Bob and I went to see you. I think it was down in Harvey. And you come up to me and you go, John, you know, I talk about you with every new comedian that I run into. And I said, what? What could you possibly talk about? And he tells that story and says, don't drink before you go on. I'm glad I could help. I could do my bit to help the comedy world. More with Tom Dreesen when we come back on 720 WGN. There's a little bit of that Tom Dreesen. 821, it's 720 WGN. You know, those comedy clubs out there in Hollywood, there's quite a few of them. And I know that comedians go there to, you know, run new material. And I didn't approach you after this, but right before COVID, I happened to be in Los Angeles taking some acting and, you know, classes. And I found out how relatively reasonable it was to go to one of these comedy clubs. I mean, the price, you know, it was like, really, it was like $40 or something, $40, $50. I'm like, for a whole, you know, a whole evening, and multiple comics would come on. You didn't really know who. But, you know, it's got to be a good deal. I mean, Dane Cook came on, and at that time he was, like, you know, super, super hot, and he's trying out new material. And then I'm sitting there, and out comes Tom Dreesen. And I'm like, what do you know about that? You're still working it.
Oh yeah, but, you know, that's part of when I first started doing the Tonight Show. You had to keep coming up with a new 6 minutes. Johnny didn't want you repeating material, and he didn't want two guys going to bar jokes. He wanted, you know, original monologues. And so I got in the habit of writing these 5-6 minute routines, and got in the habit of going to these comedy rooms and trying out the material. Mm-hmm. You know, writing the material and then trying it out, and it became a habit that I've kept through the years. And many years ago, there was just one or two maybe comedy rooms you could do that. Today, yeah, on weekends now, there's a place called Flappers in Burbank. I worked a week ago with Jay Leno over there. Then there's another place called the Comedy Chateau in North Hollywood that, yeah, I go on stage there with a lot of the hottest new young comics. Then some nights I go to the Laugh Factory on, yeah, Sunset Boulevard and work with, yeah, Dane Cook and people like that. And then I go over to the Comedy Store. A couple of weeks ago, I was working with Sebastian Maniscalco and Bill Burr.
Whoa.
You know,
yeah,
same thing, trying out new material.
Yeah.
And then it gives me an opportunity also to see if my material still works with the young audiences.
Oh, it did.
Because those rooms I just described to you, yeah,
yes,
they are, the average age is like 20 to 30
exactly,
to 40. And,
right,
and of all ethnicities, you know, you've got young Asian, young Black, young white, young Latino, all different ethnicities, you know. And so it's a great challenge for me to continue to do this, you know.
Oh, hey, I understand completely. At our particular age group demographic, I mean, that you get on stage in a situation like that, man, that is fantastic. I mean, you're still exercising that comedy muscle and, you know, not taking anything for granted. And you've had a fabulous career and you're still killing it. I mean, that's what it's all about, Tom. I mean, really, quite frankly.
This is my 55th year in show business.
Right.
I've been doing stand-up,
yeah,
for 55 years. And I still love it, John. If it was a drag or a grind,
right,
or anything,
right,
like that, then I'd say, okay, you've done enough. I really had a wonderful career. But I still so much enjoy writing something in the afternoon and that night trying it out, and it works. You know, stand-up comedy is the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. I'll let you describe the lowest of lows. I'll describe that. But you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? When you score,
it's, oh yeah,
something you had written that day, you know. And
yeah,
when I was open for, you know, I opened for a lot of, I performed my own shows for years, but through the years I toured with Sammy Davis for years, for Smokey Robinson, Natalie Cole, Gladys Knight, the Pips, Tony Orlando and Don, Frankie Avalon, James Darren, God knows how many acts I've opened for, which was always exciting. But when you open for Sinatra, and this, we did 20,000 seat arenas in like 45, 50 cities a year, these huge arenas, and you wrote something that day, and you tried it out that night in front of 20,000 people, and it worked. Oh, I can't tell you.
Well,
I can't,
you
tell
know,
you the feeling you get. You know?
I have some, we've got like about 4.5 minutes before we have to break for the bottom of the hour and come back with Tom for another half hour. But I really want to get into this Sinatra relationship as to how you got there. Because, you know, you just say Sinatra, and you're talking one of the greatest entertainers in the history of show business. I mean, one of the great vocalists ever. I mean, even, you know, generations, it doesn't matter. Even current music aficionados, no matter what age they are, Sinatra is, those pipes, man, I mean, that is really something else. In fact, I got a text already. It said, 847, Sinatra in concert at the Erie Crown, unforgettable. And to be able to be his opening act, I mean, I know it's been talked about a lot, but it's still almost like it's, oh, you know, something to be taken for granted. Yeah, he opened for Sinatra. Oh, no, no, no. You don't take that kind of thing for granted. I mean, that's just, how did you meet him? How did you meet Sinatra?
It was purely by accident and purely by being glib at the right time. I was performing with Smokey Robinson. We were touring all around the country. We were at Caesars in Lake Tahoe, and Frank was appearing next door at Harrah's. And I had worked Harrah's many times with Sammy Davis and different artists. So Smokey and I were there for like a week, and I could have gone any night to go see Frank, and I don't know why I chose the one night, but I called the maitre d' over there. They said, don't worry, Tom, we'll take care of you. After I finished my show at Caesars in Lake Tahoe, I stage left, went straight outside, and if you know anything about Tahoe, then there's a casino, and then there's Harrah's. So I ran over into Harrah's, running through the showroom, because I didn't want to miss Frank's opening. I had seen him perform, and he created more excitement walking out to the microphone than most people do with their whole act, just his appearance when he walked on stage. So I was rushing into the showroom, and the vice president of Harris Hotel, a very powerful guy named Holmes Hendrickson, he saw me, and he was talking to a big, heavyset guy with a cigar. And Holmes Hendrickson, the vice president, he said, Tommy, come here. And I reluctantly went over because I didn't want to miss Frank's opening. He said, Tommy, this is Mickey Rudin. Well, I recognized the name. That was Frank Sinatra's lawyer, a powerful guy in our industry. And he said, Mickey, this is Tom Dreesen. And I think Tom would make a great opening act for Frank Sinatra. And the lawyer got a pained expression on his face like he heard that a million times. And he winked at the vice president, but I caught it, the wink. And he looked at me and said, hey, kid, if I gave you a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000? I said, Mr. Rudin, put it this way. If you gave me a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000? He started laughing. He said, I like this kid. And a week later, they gave me a week with Frank, and it turned into touring with him. I can remember the exact night. We did two shows together, and I figured work 1 week. I'll try to get my picture taken with him and hang in every bar back in Chicago, you know. Yeah. So after the second night, he took me to dinner, he and his wife, Barbara. And in the middle of dinner, he set his knife and his fork down. He said, I like your material, and I like your style. I'd like you to do a few other dates with me if you're interested. And I didn't say, let me check my calendar.
Right.
And it turned into 14 years, 45, 50 cities a year, a friendship that I'll always treasure. I was a pallbearer at his funeral, and I spoke at his funeral. And I miss him every day of my life.
You know, I'm going to save it for when we come back on the other side of the news, but I saw a clip of you relating some advice Frank Sinatra had given you. And it's advice that actually anyone who has any kind of job could appreciate, and especially it resonated with me, I can tell you that, or anyone who's in the performing arts. And, you know, sometimes you're hot, and when you're not, you're not. I know you know what I'm talking about. We'll get to that and more. 720 WGN, John Landecker at 835 with Tom Dreesen, who, by the way, will be appearing in an evening called Tom Dreesen from Harvey to Hollywood, the man who made Sinatra laugh. And I have a pair of tickets for the fifth call at 312-981-7200. You need to go on May 11th because that's when it is. And it'll be at the Den Theater and Comedy Club at 1331 North Milwaukee. If you care for tickets, if you want to buy them, you can go to www.thedentheater.com. Their box office is 773-697-3830. It's going to be a great night. Tom Dreesen from Harvey to Hollywood, the man who made Sinatra laugh, fifth call. So I referenced Sinatra before we got to the break. And I was watching some things on YouTube or on the internet. And you spoke of the best, I think it was the best advice Sinatra ever gave you. You know what I'm talking about, I'm hoping, right?
I have to tell you, there's a couple of, there's so many things he told me through the years that I treasure, you know.
Yeah.
But you might be talking about the time when he talked about when he was the hottest thing in the country and then he wasn't.
Yep, that's the one.
Yeah, you want me to tell the story now?
Please do, or I can play a recording of you playing it.
No. I'll tell you stuff. What happened was, we were talking about the business that we're in, and you know as well as anybody, John, you've been in for a long time, that he said, Tommy, there was a time in my career I was the hottest thing in the country. I was so hot that I could call any recording company in America, and they would take my call. Any manager, any agent, any agency, they would take my call. He said, Tom, I could call the president of the United States, and he would take my call. And then I got cold, And he was talking about prior to From Here to Eternity. He said, I got where people wouldn't take my call. I couldn't get people on the phone that I had done this stuff with before. He said, I couldn't get one. And he said, and years went by, and I got hot again. That was after he won the Academy Award from Here to Eternity. He said, I got hot again. And I'd be at a party, a social event some nights, and I'd look across the room, and there's that guy that wouldn't take my call. And I'd look at him, and he couldn't look me in the eye. He'd put his head down. He said, but what he didn't understand is now I understood. I couldn't do business with him. That's why he didn't take my call. He said, it was my fault. I thought we were friends. Yeah. And it's something I never, ever forgot. Yeah. That you know, we're in show business. That's two words, show and business. And sometimes when you can't do business for them, they're not your best friend like you thought they were. It's the business we're in. But I love what Frank's humility said. It wasn't their fault. It was mine. I thought we were friends.
Yeah, well, that's the impression you're given when you're hot. Everybody's your buddy. And then when you're not, you know, then it turns into, what's the expression I've heard over my years? Don't take it personally. It's just business. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that was from The Godfather when they went to kill somebody. Don't take it personally.
It's just business. Please. I'll be able to separate that in my mind. Thank you. We're talking to Tom Dreesen, who's coming to town, as I just mentioned. We talked about being on The Tonight Show. There was an introduction by David Letterman. You were on Letterman's show how many times? I mean, the talk show guys loved you.
Well, you know, I did David about 50 times. In fact, I was the second most, Regis Philbin, I think, was on more than me on David's show. David liked him as well. And David even let me host the show while he was gone. You know, when he wasn't well, a couple of times he had shingles one time and he had open heart surgery, he'd let me host the show. So whenever I'd see him, I'd say, you know, you don't look so good. You need to take some more time off, you know. That was a fun show for me to do. And David is I'll tell you a quick story. It's got to do with Illinois. David calls me 6 months ago or so. He said, you know, Tom, every time you do an interview or I do an interview, we always tell the same story how we met. You came off stage at the Comedy Store way back in 1974, I think it was. He said, I had just moved out to California. He had an old red pickup truck, came from Indiana. He said that you came off stage at the Comedy Store. It was my first night in town, and I complimented your set, and we became friends. I said, yeah. He said, well, that's a boring story. I said, well, it's the truth. He said, I don't care. It's boring. From now on, tell people you came off stage. I had stolen some material from you, and you beat the hell out of me in the parking lot. I said, now, why would I want to say something like this? He said, because it's a better story. I said, David, you got 30 million fans. They'll be chasing you through the airport. Now, 2 weeks go by, and David calls me again. He said, Tom, do you know the governor of Illinois? And I said, no, I met him, but I don't know him. And he proceeds to tell me that his wife had a friend in Chicagoland area, and that her son was autistic, an adult, and the autistic adults, they planted corn, tomatoes, peas, and things like that. And, and they gave them away to the homeless when it came into fruition. But the state was going to come and take that property away. I said, he said, and I wanted to talk to the governor and see if I could help. I said, David, I know the Senate Majority Leader, John Cullerton. Let me call him. So I called John Cullerton at the time, and John said, oh, Tom, tell Dave, don't worry about that. Some statute or something, it's going to be taken care of. I said, John, could I have Dave call you and you tell him that story because you explain it better? He said, sure, Tom. And so I said, oh, by the way, John, when you tell David you're going to help him, tell him the only reason you're helping him is because Dreesen beat the hell out of him in the parking lot at the Comedy Store. He said, okay, you know, John Cullerton's a great guy. He said, okay, 10 minutes go by, my phone rings. I know it's Letterman. I said, hello. He said, didn't I tell you that's a better story? I told you that's a better story.
It is a better story, but unfortunately, it's not true, but it's a better story.
It's true.
Man, Tom,
he's a great guy.
I'll tell you. Now, so I'm going to back up a little bit. So here we are in Chicago early on, and how did you meet Tim Reed? How did you two get together?
I had never any dream or thought of ever going in the show business, and nor did Tim. We were in the JCs in Harvey, Illinois, a civic group, and we wrote a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor, a concept we had: make the kids laugh, play some music for them, get their attention, and then plant the seeds of the ills of drug abuse to eighth graders before they went into high school. The program became very successful with JC chapters in 50 states and in 22 foreign countries through their publications. They use it as a model program on how to teach drug education at an elementary school level. In those days, they weren't teaching drug education at a college or high school level, let alone elementary. But we wanted to get the kids before they got to high school. One day, a little eighth grade girl in Harvey in St. John's the grade school, a little eighth grade girl walking out of the classroom stopped and said to Tim and I, "You guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team." And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us because no one had ever done that before. So we start writing what we thought was material, and there weren't any comedy clubs. So we went to a jazz club one night, and we went up on stage and bombed. We didn't drink two pitchers of beer prior to the show, but it might have helped. But we bombed, and we just were going so fast, we just wanted to remember our lines. And when we came off stage, we said to the owner, "How did we do?" He said, "I don't know. You never gave me a chance to laugh. Come back tomorrow and slow down." Right. And we came back the next night and got big laughs, and then I was hooked. And we stayed together 6 years. There were no comedy clubs in America when we started out. So we worked what they call affectionately the Chitlin Circuit, black-owned, black-operated nightclubs. In Chicago, the High Chaparral, the Burning Spear, the Guys and Gals Lounge, the Cotton Club, the Dating Club Lounge. We worked these clubs. And then on the road, it was the Sugar Shack in Boston, the Club Harlem in Atlantic City, and the Cotton Club in Chicago, too. And then the 20 Grand in Detroit, Motown was in Detroit in those days. So we worked all black clubs in the North and the South. And we worked all white nightclubs, too. And we stayed together 6 years. We eventually got to Mr. Kelly's. We were a big hit at Mr. Kelly's. We got rave reviews there. And but then it was a few years later, Tim decided he wanted to be more of an actor, and the team split up and broke my heart. You know, I was hoping Tim and Tom would be one of the nation's greatest comedy teams, and I had never been on stage alone. So now I had to start all over again, you know.
Oh, man. I never thought about that, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm so accustomed to seeing you do your solo stand-up. Yeah, that had to be quite an adjustment, you know. And we all know that Tim Reed went on to be Venus Flytrap on a really successful sitcom called WKRP in Cincinnati. And I was looking up my Tom Dreesen material. And lo and behold, it said that you had appeared on Murder, She Wrote, Columbo, and WKRP. WKRP in Cincinnati got you two back together.
Yeah, it was such a joy. I love Tim. I mean, he's like a brother to me. Everything I own, everything I have, everything that I've done is because I met Tim Reed, and he feels the same way about me. His children call me Uncle Tom, which is a funny in itself. We were on a book tour when we wrote our book. We were touring around. We went to Norfolk State College, where Tim had graduated from, a historical black college. And we were at a buffet before we went to speak to the students. And I was at the buffet line with five college black professors, and we were getting our food. And Tori, his daughter, hadn't seen me in a year, and she walked into the room, and about 25 yards away, she started hollering, "Uncle Tom, Uncle Tom, Uncle Tom." And those professors turned around, looked at her, and I said, "She's talking to me, you know." And I hugged her. I said, "Honey, you got to be careful when you." She said, "Oh, I never thought about that, you know." But
right, exactly. Of course.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
So
when they brought us together, when Hugh Wilson wrote that script, and he said, "Who could play this part of a reporter from an all black magazine?" You know, and everybody said, "Well, get Tom." And for me to go back and be on with Tim and to play off of him again, like we used to do for you, it was so much fun. It was so much fun.
Okay, one of my comedy heroes, other than you, of course, is Mel Brooks. And I saw a reference that you were in Spaceballs.
Yeah.
Where was that? What was that like? What scene was that?
You know, normally you audition for things. I've done Murder, She Wrote, and Columbo's, and so many shows, Facts of Life, and shows I even forgotten, movies, Trouble with the Curve with Clint Eastwood. I did scenes with him. But Mel Brooks, to me, of course, you know, he's the epitome of comedy. He's the apex of comedy. And how I got that role, most times you audition and you read for parts and you do screen tests. I had just gotten a divorce. I'm in a bar. There was an improvisation in Santa Monica, California at the time, and I was performing there. And afterward, I went for dinner with one of my first dates. It was a tall girl, very, very, very stunning girl, attractive. Well, we go into the restaurant, and I sit at the bar. I sit down. She stays standing, and unbeknownst to me, Mel Brooks was in the restaurant. He saw this beautiful girl, and he walked all the way around and walked by, and he saw me sitting there. And he said, hey, and I had met Mel in the past. He said, hey, Greason, how are you doing? I said, oh, hi, Mel. I said, this is my friend. Her name was Trish. I said, this is my friend Trish. And he said, oh, nice. And we're talking for a minute. He said, Greason, what are you doing Monday? This was on a Saturday. He said, what are you doing Monday? I said, what do you want me to do? He said, well, I'm doing a movie. I said, I'll do it. He said, wait, I didn't even finish. I said, I don't care. I'll sweep the floor. I'll wash the windows to be with you. He said, well, it's just a few lines and so forth. I said, I want to do it. And so I went there, and they paid me for the two days. They paid me $4,000 a day to do it. And to this day, I've gotten that show. That movie has been shown more around the world than any movie. It's unbelievable. Now we get checks for 29 cents, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
87 cents, you know. But yeah, it was fun being around Mel and Carl Reiner and all those writers on that show, you know.
Yeah. What happens to your character in Spaceballs? Who are you?
I'm a guard, and the lead, and my mind blanks right now his name, but he sneaks aboard the spaceship, and I'm a guard shaving, and I think he's another guard, you know, and I holler out, you know, like, LaVaro, says, is that you? I said, wait a minute, you're not LaVaro. And I'm screaming, guard's got his ring. He's got this ring that draws things. So he draws the can of shaving cream to him, and he sprays it in my mouth while I'm screaming, and I fall on the floor dead. But here's the catch. That can was sitting, it's whipped cream inside that shaving cream can. It had been sitting for a long time, and when he sprayed it in my mouth, it was like sour milk. Well, the scene was still rolling. I'm laying on the floor wanting to die. And when Mel yelled, cut, I jumped up and ran to the bathroom and stuck my head in the toilet. Mel came in there, and he said I was nervous about the scene or something. He said, Reese, are you okay? I said, Mel, what the hell was in that can? And so he went and went, oh, my God, he said it was sour, you know. We had to do the scene a couple times over, but I was really, really leery of the spray, you know, in my mouth after that.
Tom, I got to tell you something. I'm having such a great time talking to you. I've lost complete track of the format, and my producers are, hey, break, break. I said, oh, sorry, I forgot. Oh, sorry for the snort there. 720 WGN, John Landecker with Tom Dreesen. You have published... We don't have a lot of time left, I'm sorry. But you have published over the years some really great stuff. What they were just referring to there with Letterman and some other things. Are you planning on doing any more of that?
I have a book out now called Still Standing. The subtitle is My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra. And it's on Amazon. It's a cheap plug, but it's got over 455 star reviews, and I'm real proud of it. Really proud of it, because it's getting great reaction, and it's motivating. It's a double entendre. I've been a stand-up comedian for 55 years, but I've been knocked down a lot on my way there, and I kept getting back up again, and that's what I hope people get from it. It's a book about triumph, you know, and it's doing real well, and I'm proud of it. You know?
So, Tom Dreesen, From Harvey to Hollywood, The Man Who Made Sinatra Laugh, The Den Theater and Comedy Club, May 11th, 1331 North Milwaukee Avenue, www.thedentheater.com, 773-693-8330 is the ticket office, and it's your story, I'm guessing, because it is From Harvey to Hollywood, so... You revisit
it's stand up comedy, and it's and then I segue over to a bar and I tell a story, and Frank comes on the screen, he's singing to me. It's really a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of laughs and some poignant stories, you know, about my journey. You know, it was 55 years ago that I went on stage in Chicago, and it's for me to come back. It is so much fun going back to where it all began and making those audiences laugh. It's just so exciting.
Tom Dreesen, thank you so much for spending this time with us. It's been great talking to you. Get out there and break a leg, all right?
You got it, John. And I hope to see you soon, too, buddy.
Sounds great. And I won't be drinking any pitchers of beer, so you can relax. There.